Hey there, it's Lars. Thanks for checking out the Lars Larson podcasting experience, and have a fantastic day.
The American people deserve better. They demand answers about January 6th. It begs the question that all of us should be asking, what is the speaker afraid of?
What is the speaker afraid of? That is Congressman Jim Banks from Indiana, who's an American military vet, as well as being a member of Congress. And this is the Lars Larson Show. Welcome to Honestly Provocative Talk Radio. And welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. Glad to have you on board on a Wednesday. Boy, do we have big doings going on today. I want to get to your phone calls and emails in a moment. You can always vote in our Twitter poll. You'll find that at Lars Larson Show. And if you don't like Twitter, go to LarsLarson.com. Easy enough to do, and it's free. You'll find a great question there each and every day. But I want to talk about what has happened today involving House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. And let me take you all the way back to January the 6th, the Capitol riot. Now, I think people want to know what happened. And I have my own theory about what happened on January 6th and what did not happen. Remember that the outcome of that riot on January 6th, no matter what your politics, was something so very significant for America. The only time in American history that a president has been impeached for a second time. The only time that a president has been impeached and then, in clear violation of the U.S. Constitution, put on trial in the Senate after he left office. It was a constitutional violation so significant. And if you're saying, Lars, that's just your opinion. Well, I'll tell you what. How about the opinion of the Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, John Roberts, who said, I won't even take part in that trial because you're putting a private citizen on trial. Now, the January 6th riot. I know that people broke the law. I know they've been charged with breaking the law. I know that there were people from Antifa. I know there were people from BLM. I know there were people who were Donald Trump supporters. And some of them, I think, really did break the law. Some of them have already pleaded guilty to that. That's not the issue. The issue is that that riot on January 6th was used for a rushed up, last minute impeachment of a president. And it was a civil disturbance. Now, I know for the last 6 months, the Democrats have said at every opportunity, this was an insurrection. In other words, a riot considerably smaller and considerably less damaging than the Antifa and BLM riots that plagued major American cities for the better part of a year. That this tiny little incident was an attempt to overthrow the government of the United States. That's what an insurrection is. Strangely, there have been hundreds of people charged with crimes in connection to January 6th, but nobody's been charged with sedition. No one has been charged with treason. No one's been charged with insurrection. Okay, so be it. The Democrats still want to call it an insurrection, so they demanded a special commission to investigate. Now, that's ridiculous, and let me tell you why. The Congress of the United States is empowered by the Constitution to do an investigation of its own, which is what they apparently plan to do now, although the monkey wrench thrown in today may just kill the whole thing. More than that, they're not just empowered to do investigations. The Constitution requires your members of Congress to do oversight into all of the operations of the government. The president is the executive. He runs the apparatus of government. The Congress is designed to do oversight into everything involving the government. So what does Nancy Pelosi do? She says, well, we will have a select committee in the House. That's a committee where they put the committee together for a specific purpose, not like the Agriculture Committee or the Judiciary Committee that are standing committees. This is a select committee to investigate the January 6th, as she calls it, insurrection, even though, again, I'd remind you, nobody's charged with insurrection, and report on the facts. What did she do today? She took two of the best people to ask questions who are Republicans off the committee. She said, we will not seat Jim Banks of Indiana, the man whose voice you just heard. We will not seat Jim Jordan of Ohio on that select committee. We won't let them ask those questions. Now, here's what Jim Jordan has to say about the riots and the questions he wanted to ask on that committee. Listen.
The fundamental question of why wasn't there a proper security presence at the Capitol that day? They're not going to address that. And only one person can answer that question. Only one. Speaker of the United States House of Representatives. My hunch is the reason they don't want to address that question, my hunch is because what happened all last year? The Democrats normalized anarchy. They normalized rioting and looting. And when rioters and looters attacked our law enforcement personnel, when rioters and looters destroyed small businesses, what did Democrats do? They went out and raised money to bail them out of jail, and they continue to talk about defunding the police, and in fact did that in all these major urban areas, which is why crime is up.
Now, Jim Jordan is right, but I'm not going to put words in his mouth. This is my theory about what happened January 6th, and I'll remind you, 2 days after that riot, when, you know, we had just begun to try to sort out what happened on that day. Tens of thousands of people gather on the mall. The president gives a speech, and then a few hundred out of those tens of thousands go up to the Capitol and commit crimes. Some of them did, some of them didn't. Some of that's being determined in court right now. You know what my theory is? 2 days after that riot, the FBI came out and held a news conference and said, we have been following what they have been planning on January 6th for weeks. We knew about it. We not only knew about it, we warned the Capitol Police. Now, here's where you need to know a detail. Who do the Capitol Police answer to? Not the president, not the Senate. They answer to Nancy Pelosi. So imagine this. The FBI calls up the Capitol Police Chief, who lost his job over this, and say, by the way, January 6th, you're going to have trouble. Now, does the Capitol Police Chief call his immediate supervisor, Nancy Pelosi, and say, Speaker Pelosi, the FBI says we're going to have trouble on January 6th. We should be ready for it. Now, I can only imagine what happened. I think Nancy Pelosi wanted this to happen. She said, go ahead and go about business as per usual, which is exactly what the Capitol Police did, and that's why they weren't ready for what happened. Now, my theory is Nancy Pelosi wanted an excuse to impeach Donald Trump for a second time because the Democrats are scared to death of the man. Take a listen to Jim Banks again on Nancy Pelosi.
She knows that we were prepared to fight to get to the truth, to find the facts about what happened on that day, to make sure that January 6th would never happen again. But she doesn't want to go down that path.
And I just told you why she doesn't. I think she let it happen. Jim Banks, again, about the questions that should be asked by the Democrats.
Questions that Democrats have never asked about why the Capitol was vulnerable on that day when we had intelligence for weeks leading up to January 6th that told us that something dangerous would happen on January 6th. She knew we would fight back against their political games, and that's why she didn't want us to participate in this committee. It just goes to show this is entirely a political exercise on her part. It's a shame. The American people deserve better. They demand answers about January 6th. It begs the question that all of us should be asking, what is the speaker afraid of?
Well, guess what's happened now? House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy said, if you're pulling Jim Jordan and Jim Banks off the committee, then I'm not going to put any Republicans on the committee. We will not participate. I think it's right. What the Democrats want is they want a gigantic diversion. And Jim Jordan pointed that out. He said, look, they want a diversion. We've got inflation through the roof. We've got violent crime up dramatically. We've got a wide open border with record after record being broken for illegal crossings of our border. Does Nancy Pelosi want to talk about those things? Absolutely not. Back in just a moment. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're concerned about violent crime, I've got a couple of thoughts for you coming up in the Northwest Nonsense. And that's up next.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
No left-leaning, dead fish rapper bias. No mega TV network liberal agenda. Just the cold hard facts from Lars.
If you're concerned about violent crime, you really should be. Under the feckless leadership of Northwest mayors and governors, violent crime has skyrocketed, and there is now blood in the streets, especially in the last 18 months or so. Kate and Jay, Ted and Jenny, sound like they're all talking from the same script. They say they're concerned about gun violence. Well, if you suspect these so-called leaders don't really know what they're talking about, I'd say you're absolutely right. Someone should tell these dimwit Democrats that the vast majority of violent crime, believe it or not, has absolutely nothing to do with guns. You heard me right. As usual, I'm going to offer some proof. The Crime Prevention Research Center reports 92% of all violent crimes do not involve firearms. You heard me right. 92%, repeat the fact to your liberal friends, 92% of all violent crimes do not involve firearms. Of all the rapes, robberies, sex crimes, assault, attempted murder, and murder, 8 1/4% of those involve a gun. even for the crime of murder, 26% of murders don't involve a gun. So solving gun violence, which is the watchword of, you know, Jay Inslee, Kate Brown, Ted Wheeler, Jenny Durkin of Seattle, if you solved all of it, you'd be solving 8% of violent crime. Bravo, big deal. 2 weeks ago, Kate Brown told CBS Face the Nation on national television, the level of gun violence is absolutely unacceptable. I guess the non-gun violence is then acceptable by definition. This obsession with guns leaves their communities at great risk. They are ignoring 92% of the problem. The great irony is Democrats seem to delight in demanding that law-abiding citizens stay home, shut down, mask up, pay your taxes, and otherwise shut your yap. Locking up criminals for violent crime, not so very much. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now. Brought to you by Les Schwab Tire Centers. Doing the right thing matters.
San Fran Nan, Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House of Representatives of the United States government, she gets today's grill. She has now rejected Jim Banks of Indiana, Jim Jordan of Ohio. She has said, I will not put them on the committee. She just blew the committee up because the Republicans said, if you're not going to let some of the best question askers we have, including people like Jim Banks of Indiana, an Afghanistan war veteran, you kick him off. Why? Because he's going to ask questions that make Nancy Pelosi uncomfortable. This is such a transparent move. Nancy Pelosi gets today's Daily Grill, and I would be happy to take a naysayer call on that. If anybody thinks it was justifiable to say, we want an investigation, we want to get to the truth, but we're going to kick the best people to ask questions off the committee, if anybody thinks that's justified, I'd be glad to hear the reason. Today's best email of the day so far, but you can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by River City Environmental, the leading environmental and emergency services company in the Northwest. Now hiring with full benefits, leading pay, and a signing bonus. Online at RiverCityUSA.com/careers. John Wilson writes in, Lars, I'm beyond frustrated listening to that communist governor, Kate Brown, stating that these wildfires were perpetrated by climate change. Nothing could be further from the truth. This has to do with failed forest policies and environmental liberals who refuse to allow us to go in and clean up the forests and thin out the trees. That's what's causing these wildfires and extending the life of these fires, doing further and further destruction. John, I have to agree with you. Absolutely. To your calls now. Let's start with James. Hey, James, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show. And thanks for listening. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars, longtime listener. I've been trying to call you about this. I'm going to get straight to the point. I think January 6th, there's more to it than what you said about the impeachment. I was listening live. I drive truck and I was listening to it on the live radio broadcast. Arizona was the first one to step up. They would not certify the vote. And at that time is when they went to recess. The Senate went to their side. The House went to their side. At that time, right as soon as they started to leave, is when this whole thing started to transpire on January 6th.
Well, and you may be right, but James, I would point out to you, the people who committed the riot, the FBI had had their eyes and presumably cyber ears on these people for weeks, if not months, and they reported that to the Capitol Police. So the event was planned long before that day and the vote count, but I think we knew what was going to happen. And I think we know what's happening now, James. If you've been following the news, the Arizona audit shows tens of thousands of illegitimate votes were counted in a state where Joe Biden only allegedly won by less than 11,000 votes. So were people concerned about the fact that we were seeing the certification of a fraudulent election? The same kind of thing has been found in Georgia. And Pennsylvania is now pushing for an audit of their election. And Wisconsin and Michigan should as well. So I'm concerned with you about the same kind of thing. But the event was planned long before what happened on that day, and it was not inspired or incited by the speech of Donald J. Trump. Let's go to Ron. Hey, Ron, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind today?
Lars, I am sick and tired of them trying to dispel these lies. I was there in D.C., 13th and Congress, from 9th, all the way to 13th and Constitution Avenue, right across from the Commerce Building, right across from the Ellipse, on the east side of the Ellipse. Two football fields away from the president. And when I watched on WUSA radio station, they was on on 12th Street. They had a video, a lower screen on their video camera, like they can look on a live feed what's going on. And it was hardly maybe 200, 300, 400 people at the Capitol at the time period. The president did not speak till after 3. He might have came up and spoke just to introduce people.
He was a little earlier than that. But you're right. The intrusion into the Capitol, whatever you want to call it, it was not an insurrection. Nobody's been charged with insurrection or treason or sedition or anything that would lead yourself to think that. All of those people began to head up to the Capitol building long before the event that Donald Trump was speaking at finished. So you're absolutely right about that. Ron, thanks for the call. Let's go to Port Angeles and talk to Tom. Tom, thanks for listening on KVI, a great Northwest affiliate in Seattle and on the network. What's on your mind today?
Well, the insurrection, this isn't the first time that something like this has happened. And people are getting the impression that this is, you know, something that has never happened before. So I would like to illuminate the...
Do you think it was an insurrection, an attempt to overthrow the government by having a few hundred people walk into a government building or break into a government building, whatever is the case? Is that really an attempt to take over the government?
Are you talking about the Puerto Rico Five, or are you talking about...
I'm talking about January 6th. I understand there have been other incidents, other terrorist incidents. Heck, we saw a year's worth of riots in Seattle and Portland, but nobody called those insurrections. Was this an insurrection? You called it that.
No. That's what they're calling it. No, Trump is right on the money on all this, and so are you. But I'm just trying to shed light on the fact that, you know, Jimmy Carter let a woman go who had a viable, pretty large scale explosive device.
Yes, he sure did. Tom, thanks very much. Coming up in a moment, what happens when somebody says your city, the big city, looks like blank? We're going to talk about that next. Welcome back to the program, and welcome back to the Radio Northwest Network, serving Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk radio on a daily basis. And if you are provoked and find yourself disagreeing, well, you can be a naysayer. And naysayers go right to the head of the line at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Our Twitter poll today, should the state decide what kind of a bag a store can give you, the customer? My answer to that is absolutely not. No. But Washingtonians, October the 1st, are going to be banned from getting a plastic bag, a single-use plastic bag, as they like to remind us. No longer allowed. You can answer today's Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show on Twitter or LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, I want to welcome my friend Josh Markey, longtime friend, 40 years or better, on a couple of issues. He's a former DA. Two issues to start with. Number one, today, there is this gigantic deal that's been reached between the states and the three biggest drug makers in America for a $26 billion payoff in the so-called opioid epidemic. Josh, I want to get your take on this because, number one, I don't think the pharma companies, if you had used their products as directed by your doctor, I don't think you would have had a problem, number one. Did they push things like Oxy and that sort of thing? Yes. They said this is good if you use it as directed, which is true of almost everything. But secondly, why are the states getting paid for the damage that was suffered by citizens?
Well, it's all about politics and money. Most of the states that are being super aggressive are being run by Democratic state attorneys general. And most of them that are really aggressive are the new woke state attorney generals, like the woman in New York State, Connecticut, Massachusetts. And what they're doing is they're using the power of the attorney general's office to essentially put a gun to the head of these. And we have groups of manufacturers, and then we have other groups of distributors, and then we have retailers. And as you say, if the drug is used according to the instructions that the doctor and the, you know, package insert said, they're very helpful. Do we have an opioid epidemic in America? Yes, but we don't have an opioid epidemic in America anymore of prescription pills. We have an opioid epidemic in America and in Oregon of illegal fentanyl transshipped through Mexico and China, and methamphetamine coming from most of the same places. And none of these lawsuits worth billions of dollars are going to even touch what is essentially 90% of the drug problem. I would predict in 5 or 10 years after all this money gets paid that we're going to be at least in as bad a shape as we are now, and probably worse, because essentially what they've done is they've taken targets of opportunity, established companies that may have gotten a little greedy. I'm not saying they didn't, but instead make them take responsibility for a very real problem. But because they don't have the stones or the will to essentially do what they need to do, which is to shut down illegal, mostly international drug trafficking.
By the way, let me ask you to that point, and I know this may pain you, Josh is a registered Democrat, although he's a very conservative Democrat. Does Joe Biden opening up our southern border wide open to where we are seeing record numbers, records that are broken, you know, April was broken by May was broken by June, of illegal entry to the United States, does that make the problem worse?
Yes, it does. And I voted for Joe Biden, and I don't apologize for it, but that's a big mistake. I think they're reacting mainly to, well, we're going to undo what Trump did. And the fact of the matter is there is no country in the world that doesn't maintain to some degree close control of its borders. Try getting into Canada with a DUI conviction. And instead, and I mean, there are good people. I don't mean to sound like Donald Trump. There are some, you know, people just trying to get their lives together and feed their families that come here. But there are also a lot of drug dealers. This is a great target of opportunity, and we're opening the door for them.
All right, let me ask you about a second. Oh, one last issue. On the opioid epidemic, you've looked at some of the medical studies, and you and I have talked about this a lot. When people say, oh, yeah, my son, he broke his wrist playing football, and then the doctor put him on these pills, and then the doctor kept him on too long, and now he's shooting heroin on the street. And you say, gee, which one is it? Is it the pills given to you by your doctor under a legitimate prescription, or is it the street drugs that are actually creating the greatest number of opioid deaths from overdoses in this country?
Well, let me just roll back 40 years, and the argument that used to be made, which most people would laugh at today, is that there's an unmistakable progression from smoking marijuana to shooting heroin. Now, we would all laugh at that today because we know it's ridiculous. And this is not exactly the same thing, but you've got a certain small percentage of the population that's going to have a problem with addiction. But the idea that, and yes, I'm sure that there were doctors that were too willing to prescribe these drugs. But essentially, of the drug problem in the United States right now, that ones of, you know, really people who are horribly addicted, the number that were inappropriately prescribed is probably in the single digits of percentages of the problem.
So below 10%. And because I know it's more attractive to say, my son fell victim to a doctor, rather than saying, my son was having fun getting high by shooting heroin, or daughter. And they didn't want to say that. But is it fair to say most people take most drugs, whether they're illegally taken legal drugs or illegally taken illegal drugs, they do it because, at least for a time, it's fun, right?
Right. And to do it, quote, legally is fairly expensive because you have to pay the doctor, you have to pay a pharmacy. It's much, much cheaper to get high, unfortunately, with heroin and fentanyl and meth.
Okay. Second question I want to ask you about. I happen to know Nicholas Kristof. I used to debate against him in high school, and frankly, we'd kick his ass. But, you know, because he wasn't a very good debater. But he became a columnist. He won a couple of Pulitzer Prizes, worked for the Democrats' Bible, the New York Times. And now, having been gone from the state for about a half a century, he's now said, gee, I think I'll come back and run for governor. Or he's talking about it. I want to know your unvarnished opinion of the idea of this carpetbagger coming back to run for governor in the Northwest.
I almost vomited when I read the, I think it was an Oregonian story that was just a pure puff piece. For those not in journalism, a puff piece is what it sounds like, essentially a press release that gets it printed in a newspaper. You know, it was one of these classic, we hear this from politicians all the time, I don't want to run for fill in the blank, but people are asking, they're begging me to do it. That's what Kristof is saying. You know, Oregonians are coming to me clamoring. Kristof comes from a very similar background than I do. He grew up in Oregon, the son of college professors. His father taught at Portland State. My father taught at the University of Oregon. I don't know Kristoff, but, you know, I know the trajectory. His father made an interesting choice, which is to live in this little tiny town of Yamhill in Yamhill County. Yamhill, the town, is much smaller than the county. And I think, you know, Kristoff has made some genuine, interesting observations about what's happened to people in poor white parts of America like that. However, he's taken this to, you know, he lives in this rarefied environment of the editorial board of the New York Times, and he has basically descended back and apparently reclaimed, I think 2 years ago, some land that his family owned and turned it into a winery, and has now declared himself an Oregon citizen. And there are several interesting articles in national publications that have opined that the last time a politician tried to, I mean, a journalist tried to become a politician was when William Randolph Hearst did it in the 1890s, and that was not very successful.
No, you're absolutely right. I'm concerned. This is the guy who's been anti-logging. This is the guy who came to Portland last year and said, I can't find these anarchists that Donald Trump keeps talking about. Well, it's because they were busy setting buildings on fire and assaulting the police. Josh, thanks so much for coming on the program. Coming up in a moment, I got to talk about the rocks being thrown off overpasses in the Seattle Metro and the tie to the concrete campers, the so-called homeless. We'll get to that in your phone calls coming up next on the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Radio Northwest Network. I have to tell you something. If I have a dog in the fight or a personal bias on something, I always tell you what it is. Over this past weekend, Tina and I took a long weekend. We went up to the Seattle metro area. We were up on Camino Island. We were in Bellevue. We were in Seattle proper. We were in places basically all over the Puget Sound area. And every time I drove under a freeway overpass, I mean, we'd been on 5, we'd been on 520, the bridge, we'd been on the 405, we'd been on all of those. Every single time I drove under an overpass, I was looking at that overpass thinking, am I going to be one of those people who gets hit by a rock? There have been about 161 incidents involving people throwing debris, which usually means a large chunk of concrete or a rock, off a freeway overpass. 161 incidents in the last couple of months, basically, in the Seattle metro. And I've covered it a little bit on this show, but today I saw something in the Seattle Times, the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper. I know I reserve that name for the Oregonian and the Register Guard as well, but the Seattle Times really deserves it today. They detailed the arrest of a 41-year-old man who they do not name. They simply say a 41-year-old man from Seattle has been charged for allegedly throwing rocks and debris. They don't say what the charges are. They don't say what the man's name is. They don't specifically identify that he came from a homeless camp. Although, if you read deep enough into the Fish Wrapper piece about this, they note, after surveying the area, State Department of Transportation officials said Tuesday they have found a connection between some of the incidents and their proximity to encampments near the highways. Now, I'm guessing the Daily Dead Fish Wrapper just assumes that when you hear encampments, you will understand this is the new polite woke term for drug and alcohol addicts who are living in tents next to the freeway. But if you just say encampments, it can be kind of a generic, non-judgmental way of describing them. As a result, the Fish Wrapper goes on, officials are planning to start clearing away certain encampments, including one at Benvenuto Viewpoint, another one adjacent to westbound I-90, etc. Workers will start cleaning the encampments on Thursday, even though in previous efforts, a notice of removal was posted 72 hours in advance. Because of the public safety threat in this case, however, transportation officials say they must act quickly. Yeah, so they're going to start on Thursday, tomorrow. The city will assist with debris removal, provide outreach to the people living in the right-of-way, and advise them of what options and resources are available, and will offer storage of personal possessions if needed. That's from the Department of Transportation. I want to point out to you that I have been saying for 20 years that allowing people to live in the way that these antisocial people live, and let me back that up, I would say there may be a few exceptions to this rule. There may be a roommate who is kicked out by his roommate or her roommate out of an apartment and is just temporarily between conventional housing spaces like a house or an apartment. the vast majority of people, as pointed out by Eric Johnson in his great documentary, Seattle is Dying, almost everybody who lives on the street is addicted to drugs and alcohol. Now, there are lots of drug and alcohol addicts in America. Most of them don't live in a tent by the freeway. So I would just ask you, logically, to think to yourself, how do you end up as a drug addict or an alcohol addict living in a tent next to the freeway? And the answer is, you are antisocial. That is, you have worn out your welcome with every member of your family. You have worn out your welcome probably with the boss at the job you used to have. You've worn out your welcome with all of your friends. They no longer want you sleeping on their couch or couch surfing. They've kicked you out. And now you are reduced to living next to the freeway, addicted to drugs, and probably your sole focus is getting a little something to eat, making sure the cops or others don't kick you out of where you're living right now, and finding your next fix. So, if you take an antisocial group like that, and you station them next to the freeway, that is, you allow them to set up camp there. And some of the camps, you and I have seen them in the Portland area, the Eugene area, the Salem area, the Seattle area. In almost every big city in the Northwest, you have seen these encampments. Some of them look like they have been there for months. They are shanty towns. And the officials in charge of law enforcement, who will be happy to punish you, the happy homeowner, if you don't cut your grass often enough, or if you leave some kind of hazardous tree in your yard, they will punish you for 60 different kinds of things. But if somebody sets up camp on public property and says, I'm going to live here, I'm going to defecate here, I'm going to urinate here, I'm going to shoot up drugs here, I'm going to drop my dirty needles in the parks where your kids can step on them here, they say, oh gosh, we've got to bend over backwards for these people. And only something like this, where somebody who's already antisocial enough, they've worn out their welcome everywhere, they are almost in all cases addicted to drugs or alcohol, decides, hey, wouldn't it be fun to drop a 30-pound rock through the windshield of a car going by at 60 miles an hour? Now, I would call that attempt murder. And I wish they would make the case that dropping a rock on somebody who's traveling by in a car at 60 miles an hour is attempted murder. And they should name the guy. Not only that, it should have been the lead. The headline in the Fish Wrapper, the headline on television and radio should have been, we now know where the rock throwers are coming from. Many of them, if not all of them, are coming from these homeless encampments populated with people so antisocial, the rest of their personal circle of friends and family and employers and former employers and everything else don't want anything to do with them. And they have now decided to act out against you and drop a rock through your windshield and maybe kill you as you drive on by. That was the lead line for that story that the Fish Wrapper missed. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Wednesday. Always glad to get your phone calls and your emails. You know, I have to admit, a little bit of inside baseball. There are times where we have to make up clever euphemisms or replacements for words that we are not allowed to say on the air because the FCC and the famous list of seven words you can never say on radio and television. Well, we had somebody drop one of those words yesterday. Had to take care of that. And today we've got another one, except this one we've planned for. Now, if I were trying to disguise the identity of my next guest, I would call him Alan McLovin, news editor for Willamette Week. His actual name is Aaron Mesh, and Aaron has written a story, and it's about an anonymous Instagram account. I've actually seen the video. I saw it last week. Friend said, you've got to see this video of Portland, because Portland looks like, and I've said we can replace it with, say, a member of Congress name like Adam Schiff and say Portland looks like Adam Schiff instead of saying the word that that they've actually used, because on the Internet, you can say whatever you want, use curse words and everything else. Can't do that on the radio. Aaron, welcome back to the program.
It's good to be here.
I kind of love the fact that you've got Travel Portland, which in this case is trying to promote the idea, come to Portland, forget about all that stuff you heard about the riots and the looting and the arson and the occasional murder committed by Antifa, violence committed by BLM. Don't worry about that. Come on down. It'll be fun. That little campaign is getting a quarter of the attention that the anonymous Instagram account called Portland Looks Like Blank. Fill in the blank for you, that it's getting a lot more attention because I think people see it as real.
I think that's accurate. I think that part of the reason why this Instagram account, which is anonymously run, probably has, my guess is, has very little funding, although it's certainly not an amateur hour operation. It's fairly well put together. And I think that the reason why it resonates with people and why it has 53,000 followers and counting and growing fast, by the way, it had only like 50,000 followers when we checked last week. It's rapidly expanding in its follower count. I think part of the reason why it resonates is because people who live in Portland look out their windows and feel like something's wrong.
And there is something wrong, but against this, you have the Travel Portland, I guess otherwise known as TP, that's trying to maintain the idea that, no, Portland does not look like Adam Schiff.
Yes, so the task of cleaning up the crap in this particular case falls to TP, and they say that they won't dignify this with a response, and they send us rather a long response. This is definitely getting under the skin of local marketers and public officials. The mayor, Ted Wheeler, is mad about it. You got quotes from him in this story. You know, I think it's also worth noting that local business owners who might be sympathetic to this account's ambitions feel like it has, to some degree, missed its mark, that in an attempt to vilify or to more accurately hold accountable local officials, what they ended up doing in some cases is humiliating people in distress. And I think that's a fair criticism. I also think that in reaction to that criticism, it's also really hard to figure out how do you display the results of Portland's public policies without humiliating the people who are victims of those policies.
I guess so I have less sympathy.
That's a tricky balance.
It is, but I have less sympathy, and tell me what you think of this, for people who are in self-imposed distress. That is, there's a reason you're living in a tent. There's a reason you stick a needle in your arm once or twice a day. There's a reason you're living in a decrepit, unlicensed, uninsured, unregistered RV that catches fire by the side of the road. And we feel less sympathy for people who have deliberately done things in their lives. Maybe it's a whole collection of things over years, but they have put themselves in that spot. And now they are, as you detail, defecating in broad daylight in downtown. They're living in tents. They're shooting up right in front of people taking their picture and saying, yeah, look, I got a needle in my arm. You know, at that point, I'm not that sympathetic. You did that to yourself.
Yeah, I mean, my response to that is not, in fact, to give you like the bleeding heart story, which I think your listeners are already aware of the counter argument, the bleeding heart argument. You are accurately describing how the human condition works, that people are less sympathetic to other people whose behaviors are unsympathetic. That's just a reality. And I think that if you look at the comments and the people who are contributing to this account, which, by the way, remains an anonymous account, we've been hunting around trying to figure out who runs it, and they remain solidly anonymous at this hour. But a lot of people in this city, a lot of residents contribute to the account, and we talk to them. One of the patterns that struck me is that it's service employees. People who either run or own service business, not run or own, who either work at or run service businesses, whether they're restaurants, fast food places. These are people who more often have encounters with people living on the streets and who are extremely frustrated by the content of those encounters and feel like others should see it.
Well, let me tell you something, because Aaron, my personal take on this. Last year, there was a period of time where, you know, Tina and I didn't leave the house a whole lot. I mean, you know, we'd go to the grocery store and things like that. But we drove into Portland for the first time after several months, and we drove down that corridor of I-5 where it enters the north side of the city, and we said, "What in the world is this?" And then we stopped at Delta Park, which, you know, where the Portland International Raceway is, and a lot of shopping and all that. And there's just gigantic cities in a sea of mud with people who are living in just disgusting conditions. Again, most of it self-imposed. I think people care. I mean, if somebody came up and dumped a bunch of garbage on your front lawn, you say, "Hey, that's my front lawn." If there was somebody, you know, working on jacked up cars in their front yard a block down the street, you care maybe a little less. And if it's six blocks away, maybe less. But you still look at the city you live in, the place you're in, and say, "This is disgusting. is somebody going to do something about it? And when the answer is clearly no, Ted Wheeler, Kate Brown, they're not going to do anything about this. If anything, they're going to facilitate it. It makes you angry, and you want a way to do something about it, not by violence against anybody, but by saying, okay, I'm going to send this picture all over the world.
You know, conditions have changed since the time you went down there. There's been a drought, and the mud has dried.
Oh, and I've noticed that. But there are whole shanty towns. We actually pulled on the state fire marshal. They fired the last one after all the people died last year. And we said to her, will you do something? These are illegal inhabitations, whatever they call it, in code language, you know, to say you have the power to do something. And she said, well, you raise a really good point, but we can't do anything about it. So it's nobody's job to clean it up, including Ted and Kate and Jenny and Jay and the whole crowd of that bunch. They won't do anything about it. They just say, no, we're going to studiously ignore the problem.
I think the thing you're identifying is that Portland considers itself to be a deeply compassionate city, and there's a growing number of people who are asking whether or not tolerance and neglect is the same thing as compassion.
Yeah, and it's not. It's not. I mean, look, my dad was an alcoholic. Seeing somebody who's an alcoholic in a puddle of their own vomit or whatever, it's not compassionate to say, let me see if I can get him to stay in this condition. You can read the whole story at WWeek.com. Coming up, AOC denies the existence of critical race theory in the public schools. We'll get to that next.
Why don't Republicans want us to learn how to not be racist? Why don't Republicans want kids to know how to not be racist?
That is, of course, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez straying a little bit outside of her usual haunts in climate change, predicting the end of the world as we know it, etc. You know, she's already done that. She's got to move on to some new material. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I'll be glad to get your phone calls and emails on this in just a moment or any other subject at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. This faker AOC... Remember the woman who ran for Congress saying she was from the Bronx when she was actually from a very Tony neighborhood of upstate New York? This one has now said, well, we have to teach kids not to be racist. And in fact, she even lays some of the blame to the innate characteristics of babies. Listen to what she said on CNN.
Here's something that we know neurocognitively. Babies, when they are exposed to family members, neighborhoods, etc., of one race, their eye contact, we already know this from neuroscientists, sociologists, etc., that babies already start to gravitate towards members of their own race when they are disproportionately exposed to just one race in their life. It doesn't mean that babies are racist, but what it means is that we already start to gravitate to communities and people that we already know are already acclimated to.
So in other words, babies start out as racist. I understand that AOC, already an expert on climate change, global warming, all the rest of that, is now an expert on neuroscience and what we should do with babies. But here's the problem. The problem is that American public schools have started to teach a curriculum that, as many people have pointed out, was designed for college kids. And it wasn't even appropriate for the college kids because critical race theory starts with the assumption that America is an inherently, systemically racist country. You can certainly hear that from the left. Anytime you want to let them open their mouths, they will tell you America was founded 400 years ago. Not back in 1776. It was founded, according to them, in 1619. Its entire purpose was to enslave people based on the color of their skin. Although, sad to say, America had slaves that were not black, and it also had slave owners who were people of color. But forget about all that. Don't worry about the details. What they're worried about is you have to accept the fact that if you have white skin, you are part of the oppressor class. And they're going to teach your kids that starting in about kindergarten. This is what AOC is trying to justify, to say we have to start teaching our kids not to be racist because otherwise they will be racist because they're not around other people, people of color. This is the argument she's making. And she's saying that, well, you know, this is all about guilt. Listen to what she told again, CNN.
Children do not feel guilt about racism when they learn early on what racism is. In fact, children learn to recognize it and can engage in corrective behavior early. Now, what does feel guilty are the adults who allow racism to happen in their lives and when their children acknowledge it better than some of the adults in their lives do. And so to that, I don't think that children feel guilty. I think there's a responsible way for us to talk about how to be peaceful and treat each other with respect.
No, I've got an idea for you, AOC. This is just my suggestion. You know, I'm not a climate expert like you. I'm not an expert in the neuroscience of babies like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, member of Congress and former bartender, is. No, I don't have any of those credentials on my curriculum vitae. But I could make this suggestion. How about we just treat everybody the same without regard to skin color? How about we don't tell 5 and 6 and 7-year-old little boys and girls, if we can still call them by those pronouns, how about we just say we should treat everyone with respect? And then we should evaluate people based on the content of their character and not the color of their skin. No, no, no. Perish the thought. AOC says we have to teach kids not to be racists, because otherwise they will just naturally gravitate in the direction of racism. And when she says she wants everyone else to simply acknowledge that they're racist, in other words, AOC says you're already guilty. If you've got white skin, we already know you're part of the oppressor class. You are part of the systemic racism that is America. These are people from the left. I don't know of any on the right who hate America as much as the people on the left do. And I've made that indictment all the way back. Let's say this year will be the 20th anniversary of the terrorist attacks on America on September the 11th, 2001. There were people, America-hating people, who within days of that attack on this country said, well, we must have done something to bring it on ourselves. We must have hurt those people very badly for them to want to attack us. They don't accept the fact that there are people who will hate people in America, not because we've done anything to them, because America has, I would argue, America has saved the world not once, but twice in two major world wars, that America has been more generous with immigration than every other country on the planet. If you don't believe me, ask the Chinese communists how often they let somebody emigrate to mainland China. Not that I necessarily want to live there, because it sounds like a pretty terrible place. But if people actually wanted to live in your country, do you think China, do you think Japan, even some of our allies are as generous about immigration? Think about both the government charity that we offer to the rest of the planet. We're always there when there is a disaster to try to help people out. And the private charity that actually eclipses the government charity in this country, both religious groups and non-religious groups who do all kinds of good for the rest of the world. And you say, now, having done all those things, you should know just how bad America is. And about teachers, AOC addresses this because she actually has taken the line the rest of the Democrats have taken when they got caught trying to push critical race theory, both at the local level and at the national level. They say, oh, no, we're not teaching that stuff at all. Listen to what she says about teachers.
And Republicans are using these words like critical race theory, which, again, is a law school curricula that is not even taught in schools. And their argument is, well, some teachers may be exposed to it. Oh, wow. So your child's teacher is anti-racist and is actually fluent in how to dismantle racism in the dynamics of racism in a classroom.
Yeah.
That is something that teachers should know how to do.
No, hold on. Critical race theory exists. I didn't make this up. Ibrahim Kendi and people like him made it up. And they said past discrimination can only be corrected by discrimination the opposite direction now. So in other words, if America discriminated against black Americans, and it did for a long time, and those have been corrected by federal laws and state laws and local laws and everything else, that we have to answer it by then discriminating against anybody with white skin because you bear some of the guilt for what was done 400 years ago. And yes, we've got school districts that are saying we are teaching critical race theory. Or worse than that, we're indoctrinating the teachers so that they, as one superintendent in my neck of the woods said, we are looking at everything through a lens of critical race theory, and we are teaching our teachers to do the same. Meaning, the people you pay to teach your kids, look at your kid, and if your son or daughter is white, they see that kid as part of the oppressor class. And if your child is black or brown, then your teacher is taught to see that child as a victim, as someone from whom not much is expected because they are the victim of the oppressor class. That's the nonsense that the left is still shoveling up. Glad to be with you, and always glad to take your calls. You want to jump in as a naysayer? 866-439-5277. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Coming up next, we'll talk to Larry Elder about his try for governor of California. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure, as always, to get to talk to you. And if you want to jump into the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You know, one of the great things I think about being able to work doing what I do is the ability to meet other people who do it. And while it's been a long time since I saw Larry Elder in person, I think it was the Reagan Library a million years ago. He is the host of the Larry Elder Show, but he's on leave from that because he had announced that he was going to run a campaign to replace California Governor Gavin Newsom, which, you know, I'm in favor of. I want Gavin Newsom out of there. And I think Larry Elder's a very smart guy. Larry, welcome back to the program, or welcome to the program.
Lars, thank you so much. However, I got to modify a little something that you said on leave. I may not come back, Lars, if I win this puppy. The next time you and I talk, I'll be in the governor's mansion.
I hope so, and I hope we get it. You should do a Radio Row. You know, you and I have been at Radio Rows in a bunch of different places. Can you imagine a Radio Row of conservative hosts at the California governor's mansion or whatever venue you want to choose? I would love it, but I know you've run into some trouble on this, and for the life of me, I can't see anything other than deliberate sabotage of your campaign, because would you mind explaining to my audience what the weird state of California has decided? All candidates must submit a whole pile of paperwork, redacted, unredacted, this, that, right, and the other thing. You and your team put all that together, didn't you?
Put everything together, Lars. 300 pages of documents. They wanted two copies, and it turns out apparently, one set of documents, 150 pages, the second set of documents that had to be duplicated, missed 7 pages. So they had all the documents in the first copy, but in the second copy, for whatever reason, there were 7 documents missing. And I will acknowledge that. The point, though, is the Secretary of State had the statutory duty, in my opinion, or certainly power, to have corrected it. She could have just said, well, his whole set is over here. These 7 pages are missing. Instead, I was excluded from the ballot, and we're in court right now. And in 23 minutes, the hearing starts, and I am confident that I will be determined to be admitted on the ballot. Now, this law, by the way,
yeah,
that you talked about, that requires me to get 5 years of tax returns. It was vetoed by the outgoing Democrat Governor Jerry Brown, who often had a lot more common sense than Arnold Schwarzenegger did. He vetoed it because he thought it would be unconstitutional. Well, in comes Gavin Newsom. He signs a law. It's litigated all the way up to the Supreme Court in California, the left-wing Supreme Court. They ruled 7-0 it was unconstitutional, both state constitution and U.S. Constitution, but they said it was okay as to gubernatorial elections. It isn't even clear whether it applies to a recall election. So it was used to keep me off the ballot. Most lawyers, every single lawyer I've talked to, whether he's or she has worked for Democrats or Republicans who specialize in election law, all say it was de minimis, minor, trivial. It should have been, corrected, but it wasn't by the Secretary of State. Now, one other quick thing.
Sure.
The governor submitted his papers, and they forgot to put D at the end of his name. So it turns out he's on the ballot, but not as a Democrat. He went to court to get the state Secretary of State to put the D there, and she refused to do it. So people are saying, well, Larry, you see how exacting the Secretary of State is. She did not let Gavin Newsom get his way, not putting on the D, and she's not letting you get your way. Well, the bottom line is the D did not cause him not to be on the ballot. My little mistake caused me not to be on the ballot, A and B. I read his brief, and I felt that she should have amended that, too. It was a minor little thing. Everybody knows he's a Democrat, so what difference does it make? So these were both two trivial errors. She didn't correct his, but he remains on the ballot. She didn't correct mine, but I'm off.
I'm talking to Larry Elder, who's running for governor of California, or hopes to. In 23 minutes, the hearing starts. One last little detail. Has Gavin Newsom turned over his tax returns?
No, he has not. The law does not force him to, but he claims he's already turned over 5 years of returns, and so he claims that they're available. But again, the bottom line was this was to get Donald Trump, to force Donald Trump to turn over 5 years of tax returns in order for him to qualify for the California ballot in 2020. That's before somebody stole his returns and illegally published them. And again, it was deemed to be unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. Jerry Brown vetoed it because he thought it was stupid. It is stupid. And it's just a microcosm of the incompetence of Governor Gavin Newsom. This is a guy who's watched crime go up, watched homelessness go up, watched the cost of living go up, and then shut down the state in the most severe way than any of the other 49 governors. He ignored science, shut down schools, even after the CDC said you could open them with precautions. Meanwhile, his own two kids continued to enjoy in-school, in-person private education, and he exempted his own winery from the very mandates he was foisting down the throats of the American of everybody else in California. That is why 2.2 million people, Lars, including a bunch of independents and a bunch of Democrats who just voted for him 2 years earlier, signed a petition to have him recalled. And it's a two-step deal. It's real simple. Do you want this man recalled? Who do you want to replace him? Those are the two questions that any voter will be facing. Yeah. And when it's all added up, if 50% plus one voted to replace him, then whoever got the highest number of votes to replace him will be the next governor of the state.
Larry, while we've got time, I consider Larry Elder a good friend. I would be happy to see him in the governor's mansion. So what would you do differently with the state? Remembering, of course, that you're not the entire legislature if you were the executive, but you've got some powers. What would you do?
You know, one of the reasons when people approached me to run for governor, and several people did, including my esteemed colleague Dennis Prager on Salem, I said, this place is ungovernable. You have two-thirds Democrats dominating the Assembly, two-thirds Democrats dominating the Senate. You can't get anything done. And then I talked with an election lawyer, the lawyer who was the in-house counsel for Governor Pete Wilson, one of the last Republican governors he had. He said, you'd be amazed how much power you have. I said, like what? He said, well, you have the power to veto. I said, they'll override the veto. A veto has not been overridden since the early 70s, the first iteration of Jerry Brown's term. What happens is you veto a legislation, as Arnold Schwarzenegger did hundreds of times. You go public and talk about how stupid the legislation is. The phone starts ringing. State senators and state assembly persons hear from their constituents, and they don't override the veto. So you have that power. The other power you have is the power to declare a statewide emergency that this man has used many, many times to ignore science and to slam down the economy over coronavirus. As far as I'm concerned, we have a statewide emergency on crime. We have a statewide emergency on homelessness. We have a statewide emergency on the cost of living. I've been told by a whole bunch of contractors that I talked to when preparing for this race, there are 500,000 housing units all ready to go. All you have to do is stop the lawsuits. And the lawsuits are because of a law that was passed in the 70s called CEQA, California Environmental Quality Act, that basically allows anybody to stop any construction project for any reason for an indefinite period of time. That is why we have an insufficient supply of housing. That's why the average price of a home in California is 150% more than the average price of a home in America. And according to one of the experts I've consulted, Leo Hanian, the brilliant economist from UCLA who specializes in real estate, the average price of a home in California is literally 50% more but for the stupid environmental regulations. I'm going to declare a statewide emergency on housing day one, and I'm going to suspend CEQA. It's been suspended for the Sacramento Kings Stadium for billionaires. Somehow, some way, that didn't apply for them. So when they want to suspend it, they can, but when they don't, they don't. This nonsense,
Larry,
is going to stop.
Can you imagine how the economy would explode if all of a sudden you said, we're going to start building, not in 1 year, but 500,000 housing units for everybody at every level of the income. I mean, mortgage people, finance people, people who drive an excavator, people who pound nails. All of those jobs would just explode upward if you unlock that that problem.
Absolutely, and that's why I'm asking people to go to electelder.com and help me do that. I was talking to some reporters from a black newspaper up in Sacramento, and of course, I'm an Uncle Tom, I'm a sellout, and I could tell that they weren't feeling me. And I said, aren't you upset that these liberals, rich liberals who belong to the ACLU, file motions to stop gang injunctions that inner-city residents want? They're not affected by crime. They're living in gated communities. They have private police, but they're stopping gang units, gang injunctions that inner-city parents want to stop the crime. I said, aren't you upset that these rich white liberals who belong to Sierra Club and Ducks Unlimited are stopping the construction of homes that cause the home price to be so much higher? That's why the percentage of blacks living in L.A., blacks living in San Francisco, has gone down over the last 20 years. Aren't you upset about this kind of stuff? I said, do you know anybody black who belongs to Ducks Unlimited? And they started laughing. I said, connect the dots over here.
That's Larry Elder. He's running for governor of California, depending on a court hearing. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. Pleasure to be with you, and always glad to get your phone calls and your emails at 866-439-5277. You can remember that as 866-HEY-LARS. You can also send emails to talk@larslarson.com. I love the fact that sheriffs in America are directly elected by the voters. And here in the Northwest, we have had to depend on the sheriffs to push back when there are things that are being done by state legislators in the legislatures of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. I was really pleased to see. And the reason, let me say something about sheriffs. The reason I like sheriffs so much is that the sheriff understands he or she is elected by the voters. He has a direct relationship with them, and it is renewable, or it doesn't have to be renewed. If the voters don't like the way the sheriff is doing his or her job, they can say, we're going to get somebody else. And if they do like you, they will keep returning you, like Joe Arpaio down in Maricopa County, Arizona, who stayed in his office for decades because the voters appreciated the way he did his job. So I saw this story. The vast majority of county sheriffs in Washington have signed a new letter promising to uphold your constitutional rights, but it's up to sheriffs to decide what is constitutional, what's not. The question is whether it comes to COVID. I would point out the sheriff of L.A. County came out right after L.A. County decided this past weekend. I got the word while Tina and I were on the road that L.A. County had declared, even if you're vaccinated, you must wear a mask when you are indoors in public. And the sheriff, Alex Villanueva, immediately came out and said, nope, I'm not going to enforce it. My deputies won't be enforcing it. I'm glad to see that. And I think it's fantastic that sheriffs have that kind of relationship. I only could wish that police chiefs were elected and not answerable to a bunch of politicians, as they are in almost every city in America, because that turns the police into a political organization rather than a law enforcement organization. On that note, let's go to Rob in Medford. And if you want to jump in, it's 866-439-5277. And naysayers go to the head of the line. Rob, you're not a naysayer, are you?
No, sir.
What's on your mind?
Mr. Larson, you know, there's a lot of people talk about insurrection a lot in the last year, and I'm just confused because the only insurrection that I knew of happened in Seattle, where a group of people took over part of downtown, and they literally seceded from the Union. And they took it over. They had handed out weapons. People were murdered inside of there.
Three
unarmed of them. Black people.
Yep.
And also, Jenny Durkin and Jay Inslee allowed it. So I'm just confused, Lars. How come they weren't impeached and taken off of social media? That is an actual insurrection, and it happened.
I agree with you. And this talk today, the reason I brought it up today is because Nancy Pelosi is just bound and determined. She says, we're going to investigate this insurrection on January 6th. Well, stop right there, Nancy, because you're calling it an insurrection. Nobody out of the hundreds of people charged with various crimes for what was done on January 6th. Some have already pleaded guilty to some of those charges. Some are going to take their punishment right now. Some will be found not guilty, I'm quite confident, and others will be found guilty. Okay, was it an insurrection? Yes, that's what Nancy Pelosi says. Was anyone charged with sedition or treason or insurrection? And the answer is no. Well, what do you want to investigate? Today, she decided that she would not allow two of the toughest Republicans to be on the committee to investigate. She wants this to be a political show. She wants to have them ask a bunch of questions. She wants to further indict Donald Trump. I don't know why they're still so scared of him, although if you understand the political power he still has in this country, maybe the Democrats are right to be afraid of him. But the fact is, he didn't incite that. And in fact, I think Nancy Pelosi is afraid of something else. And I haven't seen anybody mention this, Rob. But you'll remember the indictment called an impeachment when you do it to a president, but it's effectively like a criminal indictment. The indictment was that Donald Trump gave a speech and that speech incited a riot. That was the charge against him. But then the FBI comes out 2 days later and says, we've been following these yahoos for weeks. They were planning all this weeks before Donald Trump gave a speech. And there's no sign that Donald Trump did anything to get these people to go and do what they did. So Pelosi has great reason to fear that she's going to be shown up for a couple of reasons. One, that she caused the impeachment of a president and then the trial of a president in the Senate after he'd left the office, which is unconstitutional. She's going to be found out for that. She's also going to be found out because I think that Jim Jordan and Jim Banks from Indiana, who have both been kicked off this committee, and now the Republicans have said, then we're not going to put any Republicans in there. They would have asked questions like this. The FBI says it warned the Capitol Police days before January 6th that there was trouble coming. Did you know about that, Nancy Pelosi? And if she didn't know about it, then she was incompetent because the Capitol Police answered to her. If she did know about it, and they say, well, then what did you order the Capitol Police to do? Because they didn't show up with special gear. They didn't put extra people on. They didn't take any special precautions. And in fact, Donald Trump had said, I think we need 10,000 National Guard on the Capitol Mall January 6th to avoid any trouble. And his own Pentagon people said, we're not going to do what the commander-in-chief is ordering us to do. And that's a problem, too, because I've disagreed with presidents, too. But when the commander-in-chief tells the military, this is what we're doing, this is my decision, that should be absolute. And the military, apparently Pentagon, decided to ignore him. There are lots of issues there that Nancy Pelosi does not want anyone to know about. Because if she knew what the FBI had warned her police department because they answer to her, if the Capitol Police decided to ignore it on the orders of Nancy Pelosi, then Nancy Pelosi has a whole lot of trouble coming. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm always glad to get your phone calls and your emails. You know, this program attempts to, at least, and I think most days, delivers on supplying honestly provocative talk for the Pacific Northwest. And by that, I want to provoke you to think. For example, our Twitter poll today. Should the state decide what kind of bag a store can give you, the customer? Well, the state of Washington has decided that starting October 1st, it doesn't matter if you want a one single-use plastic bag. The store is forbidden to give it to you. You're not allowed to get it. I think that's crazy. I think the decision ought to be up to the customer and the store, and the state ought to stay out of that. However, it is the bag ban goes into effect on October 1st, prohibiting the distribution of single-use plastic carry-out bags. And if you say, well, it's not that big a deal, I'd agree. It's not that big a deal. They can give you a paper bag instead. In 6 months of the year when it's raining here in the Northwest, that paper bag can melt as you're walking home, and your groceries will be all over the pavement. Or you won't have any leftover plastic bags to bag other things, because many of us take those single-use bags, and we use them more than once. Well, not if I'm picking up dog doo in the backyard. In that case, I only use them one other time, and then they go straight in the trash. But the Twitter poll, should the state decide what kind of a bag a store can give you, the customer? My answer is no. You can vote any way you like at Lars Larson Show on Twitter. And if you don't like Twitter, go to my website, LarsLarson.com. And always brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, I want to talk about scooters. I like scooters. I don't happen to ride them myself, but I don't have a problem with them. The problem is that scooters have become sort of a little trendy thing, and it seems that the politicians who run the cities in the Pacific Northwest, they love every new trend that comes along. So they say, oh, we have to make way for scooters. The problem is there's a lot of danger, and they can create a lot of problems for cities. And of course, doing the trendy thing all the time doesn't always work out. I wish cities were as quick to accommodate the needs of the 95% of commuters here in the Northwest who get around in private automobiles and trucks. They do not get around on transit. They don't walk to work. They don't bicycle to work. If only they could be that accommodating of the rest, the 95% of the population, as they are of the, I don't know, maybe Mark Harmsworth, who's director of the Small Business Center at Washington Policy Center. Mark, do we know how many people might regularly commute to wherever they happen to be going on a scooter? Is it even a fraction of a percentage?
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Lars. No, it's not even that. And you have to think about what these scooters afford. I like scooters. I mean, they're kind of fun to tear around on. But when a city comes in and says, okay, we're going to replace a carbon-free method of transportation, i.e. walking, with now a scooter that's going to now generate carbon in both the construction of the scooter and then the maintenance and operation of that program, this is where the whole thing just falls apart. It really does become that environmental feel-good kind of thing that these cities are doing. And they're not really looking at the overall cost and the impact, as you've already said. There's some safety issues here. The environmental impact for the creation of these scooters, they don't last as long as they're supposed to. And when you actually look at it, if you look at it from an environmental perspective, if that's your goal, they're not actually that efficient, even compared to a car. So these things are just a feel-good thing that they put into the cities, and they're kind of fun. I'm not denying they're not, but there are also some very bad detriments that these cities are not concerned looking at, and other cities have already started pulling their scooters out of their downtown cores.
Well, and I think the problem is, Mark, you've identified this, that you're saying we're going to add a new element. Okay, great. You're going to add scooters. Where are they going to ride? Oh, on the sidewalk. Well, that's a problem for pedestrians. And where will they get dumped? On the sidewalk. Oh, well, then we'll let them ride in the roads. Oh, you're going to mix in somebody on 8-inch wheels in a tiny little vehicle that doesn't have the same warning devices, lights, and everything else that an automobile does, and you're going to mix that in with traffic and tell them they can go anywhere they want. Sounds like a problem, mostly for the guy or gal on the scooter, maybe not so much for the cars, but still, you haven't figured out where they're allowed to go. Well, they'll just figure out where they want to go on their own. Well, I don't get to do that as a pedestrian. I have to follow the rules. I don't get to do that as a bicyclist. I have to follow the rules. Same thing with a car. I have to follow a set of rules. Do they have any rules? Not based on what I've seen in Portland and Seattle. People ride those things anywhere they want.
Yeah, and the scooters get dumped. Think about helmet laws as well. If you're a bicyclist or a motorcycle rider, you have to wear a helmet. The scooters, they're supposed to wear a helmet, but they're not giving you a helmet with a scooter, because who would want to put a helmet on that's been on every Tom, Dick, and Harry's head in the city, and you don't want to do that. So, you know, technically, they're almost encouraging you to break the law by riding on a motorized vehicle without a helmet on, and several cities have run into this problem with their ordinances as well, where technically the police are supposed to issue citations to you if you don't wear a helmet while you're riding on a scooter. So they just create all sorts of problems when they're in this sort of rideshare scenario. If it's your own personal scooter, it's kind of like a bicycle. You get on there, you have your own helmet, and you follow the rules of the road. But these scooters just kind of go everywhere and cause all these safety problems. And as you just called out, they do get dumped on the sidewalk and in ditches, and they have to be retrieved, and that costs a lot of money.
And not only that, but I've noticed that they don't retrieve them with other scooters. They retrieve them with usually a gasoline-powered automobile, usually a pickup truck, because they have to have teams of people running around the cities retrieving all these scattered scooters all over, hauling them back somewhere, charging them, then taking them back to where they can be repositioned for the next day. That doesn't sound very carbon neutral either.
Yeah, that's right, and that's part of the overall cost of these programs is the work that's required to get them back in again. They originally were supposed to last 6 months. Some of these scooters only make it about 8 weeks before they're damaged and they have to be overhauled or retrofitted. And just, you know, the carbon that creates, if that's your goal, is to reduce carbon, it is not what they tell you it is. And the violations for all the safety things, Spokane has just written about. They can't even enforce these things because they're not even tracking how many of these violations are happening, and they can only give us vague numbers on just sidewalk problems. So there's a bunch of issues here that just have not been thought through.
Well, and the other thing is you're loading one more duty onto the cops, saying, okay, now police the scooters as well. Well, are they on the roads? No, they're on the sidewalks. They're here. They're at all these other places. And you say, well, how is a police officer who's already got his hands full with everything else, he's going to start enforcing the helmet laws and writing tickets to all these people on top of everything else they're doing?
Yeah, and that puts more burden on the taxpayer to pay for more officers ultimately, because those officers are now not available to enforce other crimes or enforce penalties for other crimes that happen. And you start thinking about the preferential treatment that these scooters are getting by using taxpayer subsidized sidewalks and roads for their, you know, they're getting an unfair advantage there too. So this all comes down to the taxpayers at the end of the day. We end up paying for these scooters, which aren't the panacea that they were supposed to have been.
Sounds like they're not. That's Mark Harmsworth, who's director of the Small Business Center at the Washington Policy Center. Mark, thanks very much. Coming up, some strange times in Yakima as one member of the city council finds himself excluded from the city council. We'll get into that. And later on this hour, most violent crime doesn't involve guns, but the politicians say the solution to violent crime is gun violence. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. If you've listened to this show for very long, you know that I have always been, or at least I was until it disappeared. I was a fan of the Global Supertanker, a 747 airplane, the biggest, fastest, cheapest firefighting rig on the planet. It hits all those marks. Biggest, fastest, cheapest. There was one like it on planet Earth. It was created by the late Dell Smith of Evergreen Aviation, later bought out of bankruptcy because after Dell died, the company had to go through bankruptcy. They bought the assets and made it even better, put it on a newer platform of 747. And there it sat, used by other countries, used a little bit in California, but never really used by the U.S. Forest Service, which never would explain why they rejected it. Today, a few of you have sent to me a post that was put up from New South Wales where they say, following a request from the U.S., our large air tanker, the Marie Bashir, will fly to the U.S. in the morning to assist firefighters battling more than 80 fires that have so far burnt more than 400,000 hectares across 13 states. We wish her and her crew a safe deployment. I agree with them. I hope they come to America. I hope they fight fires effectively. But it seems crazy to me. Politicians like Jay Inslee said they were offered the chance to hire the Global Supertanker last year, and they turned it down. Kate Brown did the same thing. So the Northwest politicians rejected an airplane, a firefighting rig that had been developed here in the Northwest on a Boeing airplane built by Boeing with equipment on it from a Northwest company in Oregon, Evergreen Aviation, further perfected by its new owners. And as of now, the airplane doesn't exist anymore. The Global Supertanker was decommissioned. The equipment was taken out of it, and it is somewhere on planet Earth flying cargo around instead of fighting fires. And it just seems stunning to me that this isn't a gigantic scandal. We've got hundreds of thousands of acres on fire in Washington, hundreds of thousands of acres on fire in Oregon. It looks like we're going to have a fire season that might, I don't think it'll be bigger than last year or more deadly than last year. It would be hard to eclipse the tragedies that happened last year with fires that took so many lives and burned 4,000 homes in the Pacific Northwest. But this does not smell like a good fire year. We are starting early, and it sounds like it's going to be a bad one. Could you have used that additional tanker? And I've heard from all the people who say, well, it doesn't work in the most mountainous territory. Fine. Every firefighting tool does not fit every fire. But would it have fit an awful lot of the fires that are burning right now in the Northwest? Yes. Is there a reason that Jay Inslee and Kate Brown and others said, we're not going to hire the Global Supertanker? It had FAA certification. It had all the other certifications that were required. They went through a gigantic bureaucratic process to get signed off on so that the states could use it and everything else. And as I said, for every gallon of retardant or water dropped on a fire, it was the biggest at almost 20,000 gallons. Everything else in the sky right now is less than half as big. And as the people behind the company, I have no other connection other than that I was an enthusiast for the technology. As they said, if your house is on fire, do you want them to send the biggest, baddest fire truck to your house that you can get? And if the answer is yes, when your forest is on fire, do you want them to send the fastest, cheapest by gallon, and biggest firefighting rig that can fly through the sky? And I would think the answer is yes. The answer they got from Jay Inslee and Kate Brown was no, no thanks. And the device itself no longer exists, and I suspect it will never be recreated again. Let's go to Mike. Hey, Mike, welcome to the Lars Larson Show on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind today?
Hey, good afternoon, Lars. Hey, you know, I just wanted to say that in the second there that I was listening to, you're talking about the super tanker. I'm a former wildland firefighter, and yep. when the resources are needed and you really need something real quick, usually you can grab stuff and usually you can, you know, get the resources that you need. But given the fact that there's so many things that are going on with these fires and how large they've gotten, it's kind of surprising that they got rid of that super tanker. But that's not my main point.
Okay.
My main point for calling you today was simply this. I hear about the Nancy Pelosi thing and I watch, you know, how they question the Trump supporters. And I kind of think that that was kind of a Trojan horse. And here's my reason why, because the people that went into that Capitol building and filmed the shooting of Ashley Babbitt One guy in particular, his name's John Sullivan. He's a former Olympic speed skater. He's also a BLM activist. And he went in there with Jade Sacker. He's a CNN filmmaker. And they were the ones that filmed the shooting of Ashley Babbitt. And I can tell you this. There's on the video, you can look at it. You can hear John Sullivan say, or Jade Sacker say that, hey, you know what? You were right. We did it. And Sullivan replied to this guy, and he says, I was trying to tell you, but I couldn't say much. So, you know, the guy has faced federal charges for rioting and criminal mischief for a BLM protest in Utah prior to the January 6th.
We've talked about him, but I want you to get to your point, though.
I just was wondering, you know, how is that not brought out in the public eye? Because you don't hear much about it. So what I'm basically wondering.
Do you smell what's going on right now? You've got
absolutely.
Nancy Pelosi, who has all the marbles in the House of Reps. She's got the majority right now. I think she's going to lose it next year, but she's got it right now. And she says, we want the truth. Now, if I told you I want the truth, and I'm going to assemble a panel of people to ask questions, would you think, Mike, that if I really wanted the truth, I would say I want the best people who will ask the toughest questions from every point of view? Nancy Pelosi does not want that. Because there's a lot of danger there for Nancy Pelosi. I think we're going to find out, if we ever get to the bottom of it, that Pelosi knew about the FBI's warnings because the FBI says they warned the Capitol cops and the Capitol cops answered to her. Well, if she has people like Jim Jordan, who she rejected, and Jim Banks from Indiana, who she rejected, who are both really tough people to ask questions, they would ask very good questions. And if you're afraid of somebody asking tough questions, I run into this all the time, Mike, you know this. I can't get Jay Inslee to come on. I can't get Kate Brown. I get Democrats occasionally. And I always point out to them, you're from the other side of the aisle. That's okay. Just let me ask you a few questions. If you've got your ducks in a row, you'll be able to answer the questions. And if you can't, the audience will hear it. Even if you give no answer at all, sometimes no answer is all the answer I need. So if she allows them on that panel, and she won't, and therefore all the Republicans are backing out of it, she's afraid of finding of the American public finding out everything that happened that day. Like answers the questions you ask. I'm still asking, why is it 6 months later we don't know, or well, we've found out through other means, the name of the cop who shot a woman to death, Ashley Babbitt. And you say, well, every shooting involving a police officer in America, we may not find out the officer's name the first couple of days, but we find it out eventually. And then we find out, has he had other problems with guns? Turns out that lieutenant who shot her had had problems. He had forgotten his gun. He had mishandled his gun. And you say, is it possible that had something to do with why he shot Ashley Babbitt? He made a mistake. Probably. And you say, well, if he mistakenly shot her, that's manslaughter. If he deliberately shot her and he didn't have good legal cause, that's murder. But we don't have any of those answers. All they said is, we're not going to prosecute the case. We're not going to tell you who the guy is. We're not going to tell you any of that stuff. Do you think Nancy Pelosi sees anything good coming to Nancy Pelosi and the Democrat Party out of asking hard questions about what happened? So publicly, she, and backed up by the news media, will say she wants all the tough questions answered. And then she excludes the very people who could do the best job. Coming up, let's talk about violent crime, because most violent crime, believe it or not, is not related to guns at all. 92% of it has nothing to do with guns. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. These days, if you listen to politicians from the left, they will tell you that America does not really have a problem with violent crime. We have a problem with gun crime. At least they choose to call it gun crime, as though an inanimate metal or plastic object called a gun can go out and commit crimes. But if you actually take a look at the numbers, the violent crime problem is, for the most part, not about guns at all, despite what you might hear from Nancy Pelosi, from Joe Biden, from all of the folks on the left who say, this is about guns. Well, the guy who can tell you the numbers and knows that it's not mostly about guns, in fact, it's about 92% not about guns, is Dr. John Lott, the president of the Crime Prevention Research Center and the author of Gun Control Myths, How Politicians, the Media, and Botched Studies Have Twisted the Facts on Gun Control. John, welcome back to the program. And I should mention, I serve on the uncompensated on the board of directors of the Crime Prevention Research Center. Thanks for taking the time today.
Oh, no, thanks for having me on, Lars.
So when you hear Joe Biden say gun violence, that this is about gun crime and gun violence, and Jen Psaki has said the same, and so has Kamala Harris, they're all singing off the same sheet of music. Is violent crime in America about guns mostly at all?
As long as we've had data for decades, over 90% of violent crime doesn't involve guns at all. Biden, strangely, his proposals to go and deal with the surge that we've had in violent crime, and it's violent crime across the board. In fact, in many places, it's non-gun violent crime that's increased much more than violent crime with a gun. So my guess is the latest data probably even shows a drop below the 8% of violent crime that's historically been involved with guns. But the solutions that they focus on only deal with guns. And I think that's problematic because as you and I have talked about in the past, I don't think their solutions are going to solve gun crime. And the obvious solutions for dealing with the violent crime overall are things that they don't want to talk about. You look at Biden, he's given three major speeches on gun violence. He's mentioned police a total of four times in those three talks. One of them was dealing with the enforcement of gun control laws. I think there's some obvious things that have happened over the last year. We've had large number of inmates being released from jails and prisons across the country. In many places, over half the inmates, many violent criminals have been released. You see police being ordered to stand down, budgets cut. In New York City, they cut the police budget by $1 billion. And then you see prosecutors refusing to prosecute violent criminals in places from Philadelphia to Portland. And, it's not rocket science to me about what needs to be done. But if you look at Biden's speeches, not one mention of these Democratic prosecutors refusing to prosecute violent criminals. No mentions, not one mention of all the violent criminals that have been released from jails and prisons across the country over the last year. And really no real mention of the important role that the police have. So I think, it's a puzzle why they think they want to blame all this on guns.
Well, let's talk about some of the specifics. Murder is up dramatically. Now, there's some big cities like Chicago where shootings happen so frequently that they haven't seen as much of a percentage increase. But there are cities in America that have seen the murder rate go up by hundreds of percentage points. In other words, 200%, 300%, as much as 600%. But robberies are up, rapes are up, sex crimes are up 35%. And as you point out, the vast majority of those violent felony crimes are committed without a gun.
Right. Look, a place like Chicago, it's pretty obvious what's going on. Over a year ago, the arrest rate for murders was like 20%. I believe it's probably gone down since then. And it's much harder to go and solve with an arrest a gang murder than it is to go and solve other types of murders. And so you're probably talking about something in the low teens where gang murders result in arrest. If you're not prosecuting all of them or trying to get significant penalties for them, you're having even a smaller percentage that's even going to be punished. So is it really surprising that if you have such a low rate of murderers being arrested and convicted, that you're going to have a lot more of that type of crime? Just by comparison, nationally, about 64% of murders result in arrest. But just this past weekend, the D.C. Police Union complained that they weren't being allowed to go and do their jobs when it comes to doing things like stopping murders. So if you're not catching these guys, is it surprising that you have more of those? And this notion that somehow, you look at the different proposals that Biden has here, the stabilizing brace. As far as I know, there's not been a big increase in crime.
By the way, John, so people understand, the stabilizing brace John's talking about was originally developed so that many of them veterans who had come back from service missing a limb would be capable of holding a pistol and pointing it, both for target practice and also for self-protection. That's why they created it. Now, it doesn't mean that only disabled people buy the brace, but Joe Biden says we're going to go after the gun brace. And there doesn't seem to be much sign at all that those are the biggest problem when it comes to violent crime in America.
Look, I mean, the stabilizing brace is a strap that attaches to the gun and wraps around the person's arm. So mainly, you know, if a veteran or a disabled person lost part of their hand, or if their arm was crippled in some way, it allows them to be able to hold a gun in self-defense. But look, and this is what you see throughout, there's no discussion about the cost and benefits. So they want to go and classify stabilizing braces as machine guns, where you have to go and pay the fee and then go through a
$200
or more background check that's going to be there. You know, what about disabled people that are going to find it difficult to go and defend themselves and their families? You know, they point to one crime that occurred with a stabilizing brace. As far as I know, had nothing to do with the person's ability to go and commit the crime. But, you know, you look at the discussion about rogue gun dealers. Well, everybody wants to stop gun dealers who may be selling guns secretly out of the back of their store to criminals.
Yep.
But that's not what we're talking about here. What they're talking about with the zero tolerance policy is if there's a mistake in filling out the forms, no matter how trivial, then you're out of business. Just one mistake. So you may have sold 1,000 guns over the last 10 years, and in one of the forms in the county box, you wrote down the city again. Is it consequential? No. Is it going to make it so that law enforcement can't do its job? No. They're basically saying we're going to have a zero-tolerance policy. Any mistakes we're going to use to put these gun dealers out of business. This is just one of many types of things that they're just going to make it costly for people to sell guns. They're going to make it more difficult for people to be able to go and buy guns and raise the price of guns. It's one out of many different types of policies, from going back to Operation Choke Point, that was developed in the Obama administration, where they...
To try to use banking to put the gun dealers out of business. Dr. John Lott is the president of the Crime Prevention Research Bureau. He points out just about 8% of violent crime in America involves a gun. 92% of violent crime in America does not involve guns in any way whatsoever. John, thank you so much for the time. Glad to be with you on a Wednesday. Always glad to take your phone calls and emails. Coming up in just a moment, we got a lot to talk about here, and we'll get your calls too at 866-439-5277. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's the Radio Northwest Network serving Oregon, Washington, and Idaho with honestly provocative talk. And this segment of the show is brought to you by Marquee Hot Tubs. They'll give you the hot tub swim and spa experience. Visit online or go to one of their three locations listed at MarqueeHotTubs.com. Now, I want to get Kevin on the air. Kevin, you called in to ask about the aerial firefighting 747 that I've been such an enthusiastic supporter of. And now the airplane is gone, dead and gone at this point. What's your question?
Yep. Actually, no, I work for an aerial firefighting company, and we try to purchase it, and they wouldn't sell it to us. Simply, they'd only sell it to us as a freighter.
As a freighter. Because what? Were you asking for a different price? You said you wanted to buy it with all the gear on board and everything?
Yep. Our company did, and they wouldn't sell it to us that way.
Did they explain why?
They did not. I'm getting a second. I'm a crew chief for a 737 firefighter. I'm not one of the fleet guys. It's the information I was given when they told us about it.
Okay. Because, I mean, ordinarily, somebody who's selling something would sell it for, you know, to whoever's willing to offer the greatest amount of money, assuming you're doing something, you know, legal. And in your case, you work for a company that fights fires from the air.
Yep.
Kevin, this has always been a mystery to me. I mean, I was enthused by the technology, you know, when it first came around 20 years ago, but I've never been able to get a solid answer as to why the U.S. Forest Service just would not even consider it. and why most of the states would not consider it. And when it was last offered up to Oregon and California a year ago, I thought, well, Jay Inslee and Kate Brown could put it under contract, an on-call or will-call contract, and they wouldn't do that. And then shortly after that, I heard the company had pulled the plug and said, we're going to take all the gear out of it, and we're going to put the freighter, you know, the 747 plane itself, back into service as a freighter where you can make money by moving cargo around the planet. And you say, okay, great. What happens to it now? Probably nothing. I don't ever expect to see it put together again. And I've never been able to understand why those in charge of fighting fires wouldn't say, we want this tool to use on the fires where it makes sense. And clearly, there are some places where it wouldn't make sense. But like I tell people, if you have a house fire at your house and you expect the fire department to send a ladder truck, if you don't have a four-story house, they're probably not going to send the ladder truck because that's not the right tool for the job. I mean, there are lots of examples where there are tools that are very handy for the right job, but they wouldn't use this airplane for anything. And I could never understand it. Do you have any insights to that?
No. I know we use smaller planes. We can get into small airports. Yes, they carry less water. We can get back a little faster. But the amount of water that we put down on one run was very valuable.
Yeah, well, valuable. But let me ask you this. When people say, well, is it that much bigger? The 747 was twice as big as I understand, the next biggest, which was a DC-10 at about 8,000 gallons. This thing would carry 20,000 or almost 20,000 gallons. And the little planes, especially the ones that can scoop out of a lake, those will be a couple of thousand gallons. So you say, you know, does it take time to fly to an airport and rewater? Yeah, on the ground, they could turn the thing around in 30 minutes, rewatered and back in the air. And you say, well, why not use the smaller planes? You say, because if you have a plane that holds 3,000 gallons and you have one that holds 19,000 gallons and you can get out of one trip what it would take you six trips in the smaller airplane to do, there's a clear advantage there. And I, you know, Kevin, I bugged the Forest Service forever and said, well just have somebody come on or talk to me off the air and tell me what is the reason you won't use it. The U.S. Forest Service would never explain. The Oregon Department of Forestry would never explain. The Washington Department of Forestry would never explain. And when people refuse to explain something, it makes me suspect they don't have an explanation.
And we bid a contract for Oregon to give them 10 aircraft. They said no, so all of our stuff is now fighting California.
Yeah, and they were, and you were offering them a contract. Did they give you a reason to say, no, we don't need 10 aircraft? And did they do it before everything caught fire a few weeks ago?
I believe we were too expensive, but we offered a whole system from scouting to refueling to our own maintenance teams on the ground to keep them going right then and there. But they told us we were too expensive.
Well, consider this. How expensive is it to have the forest catch fire? Last year, the state of Oregon spent $1.3 billion fighting fires. And you say, okay, how expensive is too expensive when you've got the loss of the timber, the loss of 4,000 homes last year, the damage to human beings, the deaths that occurred? How expensive is too expensive? I think sometimes these people are being cheap. And by the way, do you understand there's another firefighting tanker that's being brought in from the other side of the planet right now? The Marie Bashir, which I guess is out of New South Wales?
I heard of that, yep.
Yeah, so imagine this. It's not too expensive to bring in an airplane from the one airplane from the other side of the planet to do a job, but it's too expensive to hire a company in Chico, California, to hire the 747. They let the resource go away altogether. It's not there anymore. It doesn't exist anymore. And while the equipment that was inside that plane still exists somewhere, probably in a warehouse, I don't ever expect to see it put in another airplane again, which I think is a loss to the whole country.
I agree.
Unfortunately. So good luck to you. Stay safe out there. And I hope you put out a lot of fires in California, and it seems odd that they wouldn't hire you to deal with things here in the Pacific Northwest. Our Twitter poll today is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. Should the state decide what kind of bag a store can give to you, the customer? And I would say no, they shouldn't. It should be up to you and the store. Brought to you by Ultimate Truck Service. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show.